You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te waia mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Death Science this week, our expert, Dr. Kushal McGovern, chats with us about the socioeconomics of aging, the global fungal network, and the impact of cyclones on orangutans. For Greenwild this week, News Director Castor spoke to Chairperson of Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki, Catherine Delahunty, about the Conservation Amendment Bill and how it undermines existing legal protections in the Coromandel region. News Teamer Thomas spoke to Deputy Secretary of the Workers' First Union, Anita Rosentreter, about the struggles faced by New Zealand's ambulance services. I spoke with Associate Professor of Global Studies at the University of Auckland, Chris Ogden, about President Trump's announced peace deal with Iran. And I spoke with Professor in Urban Planning at the University of Auckland, Timothy Welch, about the Labour Party's announced caps on public transport fees if they win the election. He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waimai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ene kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia tīmata te whakaturanga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Dear Science, this week we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushal McGovern.
Kia ora.
What does the world of science have for us this week?
Oh, some really interesting stuff this week. So first off, biological aging and how we grow up and how we're living affects our biological age. So first, a couple of concepts. Biological age is basically a measure of how old our cells and organs are at a molecular level. So it's as opposed to chronological age, which is how many years we've been alive. And so you can think of it basically as it's a measure of the wear and tear that's been gone on your body. And so you can, as you can imagine, it's influenced by, you know, diet, sleep, stress, genetics, your environment. And so it's quite a strong predictor of disease risk and lifespan. And the way that we basically determine biological age is we study the epigenome. And so the epigenome is basically a collection of chemical changes that happen to our DNA that affects when, where, and how our DNA is actually expressed. And so to measure this, the final concept is epigenetic clocks. So we use these epigenetic clocks basically to measure epigenome stage changes that are associated with age. And as you can imagine, there's been a lot of different types of these epigenetic clocks developed. So there's a first generation, which was just about trying to guess chronological age. There was a second generation, or is a second generation, which are more about predicting health-related outcomes and mortality. And then the third generation are trained on longitudinal data, so they're taken multiple samples taken through someone's life and on a large number of people. And it's kind of giving you concept of how fast you age, so your aging rate. Now, what a lot of previous studies had indicated was that these epigenetic clocks and their measures are sensitive to socioeconomic, racial, and ethnic disparities, which is it is interesting and good for us to understand in terms of bettering our society. But it was kind of unclear which the epigenetic clocks best captured these effects and what social determinants were having the most effect on health, what stage of life, had the most effect, what the socioeconomic exposure had the most effect. And so there's kind of a whole bunch of questions.
A complex set of questions.
Yeah, you know, right? And so what this study was able to do is they've accumulated the data from 140 other studies. So this means they have data from nearly 66,000 individuals, so a big, big data set. And they wanted to see if these associations between biological age and socioeconomics were actually consistent and robust. So it wasn't just that one study found it, but not another study. You know, like having all this data, it's to really go, yeah, no, this is actually a thing. And what they did find was there is actually a robust pattern. So people who experience social disadvantage tend to biologically age faster. And so this was actually strongest when they used these newer, so these second and third generation epigenetic clocks. But what was really interesting is that it starts early in life. So children growing up in poorer conditions, like lower socioeconomic circumstances, they will biologically age faster. And even once you become an adult, if you grow up in a disadvantaged family, you'll still age faster even later in life than even decades after that childhood exposure. So it kind of it sticks with you to some extent. And then there was some US-based studies that were part of this larger, this accumulation of studies where they were able to look at racial discrimination and how it affects biological age, and there was an association. And so what this kind of study fundamentally says is, like, yes, these epigenetic clocks are useful. There is this robust association. And then maybe in the future that they can actually be used to help evaluate interventions. So if you have a poverty reduction program or education policies and start to really go, yes, this is making a difference, or no, it's not. And yeah. So.
But yeah, it always a difficult one. Right?
Yeah, right. It's not necessarily a surprising result, but it's, yeah, you do need a lot of data to actually go, yeah, this is real, this is robust. But yeah, very difficult.
Especially to get anything done, right? You need to have that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to just kind of wallow, and that's not good. We don't like that.
Yeah.
It's potentially a good start.
Yes.
That's the optimistic way of looking at it.
Yeah, because there's been, with these epigenetic clocks, there's been a lot of discussion about how useful they are, because on a population standpoint, they're probably really useful, but people have then also started trying to use them on an individual level to go, you know, I'm this biological age, so I'm in good health, or, you know, I've got to change these things. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Not the greatest indicator, I guess.
Yeah, no, you have to be a little bit more careful about interpretation of results when it's on the individual level, but yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, what have we got up next? So I'm excited for this one.
This, yeah. So I love the phrase wood wide web. So whenever I see a story about the mycorrhizal fungal network, I am there for it. And so this is about basically the first global map that's been produced of the arbuscular mycorrhizal network. So mycorrhizal network, it's fungi, it's under the ground, it's below forests and plant communities. And basically, these are these fungi where they have these really branched, thin threads called hyphae, and they branch out and they form basically a two-way pipe system that channels nutrients to plants and takes carbon from plants back into the fungi. Arbuscular specifically means that its hyphae actually enter the plant roots and then penetrate into the plant cells, so they really get their nutrient right there, whereas there's another form called mycorrhizal, which they penetrate into the roots but not into the cells. So just a minor sort of difference where this one focused on the arbuscular. And what they have done is basically, mapped the density of these things around the globe and found that actually in high altitude grasslands or flooded grasslands, so think the Everglades in Florida, this is where they're most dense, which was kind of a shock to me. I had never really thought about where they would be most dense, but it turns out where that is.
It kind of makes sense, but it also feels surprising.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's an interesting one, right? And like I think like you, I just like fungi.
They're just amazing things.
Awesome, right? But there is actually a really significant reason for studying this in that, you know, I just said that they take the carbon from the plants, right? They're a carbon sink. And it turns out that they, about 3.9 million tons of carbon dioxide per year go into our fungal network, which is about 11% of the global fossil fuel emissions in 2021. So, you know, these are really important for the Earth's health. And we didn't really know where they were distributed.
Yeah.
So you can understand why these scientists went, oh, this is a little bit of a problem. And again, this is one of these studies that have taken a whole bunch of previous studies. So in this case, it was 322 previous studies, which had taken soil core samples. So you take a sample of the soil, and then you're basically determining the density of these hyphae within it. And so they had data from over 16,500 cores. So again, a lot of data. And again, using AI to help with accumulating all that data and interpreting it to predict a map of this arbuscular mycorrhizal fungal network for every square kilometre of topsoil worldwide. So you can go online and you can see this map. It's very cool. And what's really interesting is the way, well, what I found really interesting is some of the numbers. So the way that you express density of these fungi in the soil is actually in a length over volume measure. So you basically think of stretching out the hyphae end to end, measuring that distance taken within a volume. So specifically, how many meters per cubic centimeter of soil? So a 1 by 1 by 1 centimeter thing of soil, on average, has 4.4 meters worth of hyphae. Like, so these things, these hyphae are really small. You have the runners, which are about 20 microns in diameter, and then from them, things that range from 1 to 10 microns in diameter, and then there's, like, the things that penetrate cells are less than 1 micron. So they're really tiny, so that's how you can kind of pack so much in. But it's just amazing. So, like, in those wild grassland areas where it's really dense, it's 6.6 meters. And then the lowest density actually happens under areas of cultivated trees, so it's about 3.8. What's also really mind-blowing is if you stretch them all the ones from around the globe out end to end, they predict it's about 110 quadrillion kilometres, which is...
Just a bit.
About 10% the length of the Milky Way, or a billion times the distance of the Earth to the Sun. So we can't even really picture those numbers, right?
Just absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
What on earth?
And then, well, on the downside, what this map has also indicated is it does reveal that agricultural practices are decimating these underground networks. They can't say what agricultural practices, but they can see in the regions where there's a lot of cultivation that there's not as much. And so you can think, like, yeah, if you're using fungicides, if you're using phosphorus and nitrogen fertilizers, you know, they probably are having some effect on this fungi network. In the future, there does need to be a lot of more data come out of tropical rainforest areas and deserts, because, of course, when you're probably running your studies, you may be not going into the middle of the rainforest to try and dig at your soil cores. That's quite hard. Probably the same with the desert. So they predict in 5 years' time they'll have an update for this map that will be even more accurate and even cover areas with greater accuracy, so less uncertainty. But what they do hope is that maybe this will be used for making decisions about conservation and restoration, because then we have more of an idea of what's going on.
Because these are important networks. These are important networks that we shouldn't decimate.
Exactly right, and we don't really think about it.
And it's unfortunate that we don't think about them, because they're so cool.
Yeah, they really are.
Moving from a more grim, topic. So what do we have?
This is a bit grim. It's a little bit of a continuation on the primate theme from a couple of weeks ago. But a lot of people probably have seen the headline that 7% of the global population of this certain type of orangutan has been killed in a period of 4 days last year. So what it is, it's the Tapu Nui orangutan. It's the world's rarest great ape. It was only classified as a new species in 2017, and it has the scientific name Pongo tapuliniensis, and it's been determined that it's distinct from the Bornean and the Sumatran orangutans. And so it lives primarily in the Batang Toru forest in northern Sumatra in Indonesia. So back in 2019, when they made an estimate of how many individuals were alive, it was the whopping number of 767 in the world.
Not a lot,
right? 581 of which were living in the forests of the western block of this Batang Toru. And like most animals, they've been pushed to the brink of extinction by habitat destruction. which became so much worse last year in November, when this area basically over 4 days suffered from this tropical cyclone, which brought on this extreme rainfall, which led to catastrophic landslides. So in 4 days, they got 56 centimetres of rain, like a lot of rain. Now, orangutans, like many great apes actually, are quite vulnerable to these environmental shocks because they actually have a slow rate of reproduction. Mm. Orangutans are only breed every 6 to 9 years. And they're heavily dependent on tree cover to survive. So when you get a lot of rain, that's kind of damaging your trees. It's a problem. When you get a lot of landslides that are damaging the ground in which those trees are, again, a big problem. So over 8,000 hectares of forest of this habitat, there were greater than 50,000 scars identified from landslides. And if you look at the way they've done this is they've compared pre- and post-cyclone satellite imagery. And you can see these images online and, like, post. Like, I didn't think it would be as obvious as it was, but it's mind-boggling. It goes from being just a picture of deep green to deep green and strips of brown everywhere. And so
it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it would. And so with these satellite imageries and these population estimates, this is how they get to this number of 58 individuals have died probably due to drowning, suffocation under landslides, and from collapsing trees. Because, of course, you might be in an area and you're moving to try and get away from it, but it's 4 days long, the cyclone, and so your chances are kind of low that you're not going to get some effect. So really, really bad for the biodiversity or for the genetic, having its genetics basically, having so much of it obliterated, the fact that it doesn't, they don't reproduce very much or it's at a fast rate. So it's a big hit. Yeah. But it's going to keep hitting because it doesn't end there because, you know, like they require these trees to survive. These trees have all been knocked down, so they've got to regrow. You had landslides, which have taken out the topsoil. What's in the topsoil? The mycorrhizal fungal network.
Yeah.
That helps these plants grow. So the actual rate at which these plants grow is going to be affected by that. And, they need these leaves. They need these fruit to survive. And so it's going to take – hopefully they can bounce back. I think they say if in the next – over the next few years, if they lose even 1% of the population each year, they're probably not going to bounce back. But – there's a lot of effort. Like, the government of Indonesia have actually stopped development in that area at the moment so that they can get a grip of, like, what is the extent of damage? How do we proceed from here? Which is quite admirable. But climate change does mean that there's going to be an increasing frequency and intensity of these massive rainfall events. So fingers crossed for the Tapanuli orangutan.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a
harrowing consequence of... I mean, us. Thanks. In case our regular destruction of their habitat wasn't enough.
We've
set up the world to do it for us.
Yeah. There was one story I read where it was a rescue worker who they were going in afterwards, and, of course, a lot of people lost their lives, but they were just, you know, like the first orangutan they saw was quite an impact on them, right, because they just hadn't expected to see it. And, yeah.
Damn, well... a sad note to end it is, on, but that's the way of science.
Yes.
Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, science. Ngā kōrero rererangi Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the dark sky movement, featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back.
Lay my belly on a woman. Leave her dancing for the lala. Take her for the damn, the damn, the damn. Fine wine and foie gras. In my view, nothing's ever given away. I believe to advance, then you must pay. In my view, love will never come my way. So when I leave,
Come on, sin again, sin again, and then I sin again, 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 again. I really wanna take your honor. I'm writing blank checks, I'm a greedy bugger. I take your daughter to feel the thunder. Daddy's little girl, now they'll be mine.
What's this button do?
Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Welcome back to The Wire. That song you were listening to, I'm looking, it was in my wine? In my view, by Young Fathers. You could have just turned on your mic. The government claims its new conservation amendment bill will improve protections of conservation land while also enabling more economic growth. Its opponents say the bill will undermine existing protections, however, especially as it enables the sale of large swathes of conservation land into private ownership. This would also undermine existing legal protections for land, specifically in the Coromandel, which, alongside the Fast Track Bill, illustrates this government's intention to entirely circumvent many of New Zealand's long-standing environmental policies. To discuss the Conservation Amendment Bill, what makes it an interesting policy, and how it could end up affecting local conservation efforts in the region, I spoke to Chair of Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki, Catherine Delahunty. And the Conservation Amendment Bill, it's a bit nebulous in some of the ways that the government has presented it to the public. What is the bill actually doing? What's the government's goal through introducing it, and what are the actual ramifications if it comes through?
Yeah, this bill is quite deceptive in the sense that it talks about sort of tidying up aspects of commercialisation of the dock estate. But if you read the fine print in a place called Schedule 5, they talk about disposing of up to 60% of dock land across the country if they want to. They want to have the legal right to do that. And that includes, for our area, in the Hauraki Coromandel, about 40% of the land area is conservation land, and all of it, except for a tiny section, a couple of tiny reserves in Whangata, is open for sale. So, you know, this is really, really shocking. It's on two levels. It's the sale of a state asset without our permission, you know, as citizens, but it's also for us in our area, which is really important to the Tamaki Makaurau area, is that this beautiful land that's been set aside for protection is going to be open for sale. And of course, the first thing that springs to mind is, oh, the mining companies, it'll be easier for them to buy it than have to persuade the courts and the landowner, whether it's the Crown or local people, that they should let it be mined. So, you know, this is really serious for us. We've worked hard for many years to set up protections for the area. We got legal protection under a thing called Schedule 4 of the Crown Minerals Act, which actually protects this land from open cast mining north of Thames. But that is irrelevant now because if the land, all of that land is open for sale. They haven't acknowledged Schedule 4 in the Act. They haven't said, or they have, but they've excluded Coromandel. So, you know, this has been very duplicitous because it's very, we've had to unpack it to find it, but it's there and it's disposing, talking about disposing of 60% of the land nationally, and most of our area could be disposed of.
And more looking at the policy side of things for a moment, is there precedent for the government selling this amount of publicly owned land, or are there sort of processes that are usually in place for this sort of thing?
Well, no, I mean, probably before you were born, and many of your listeners, in 1984, Roger Douglas decided the whole country, all the state assets would be for sale. And there was a massive fight led by Tangata Whenua against that. But basically what resulted was the sell-off of large quantities of resources and assets and land. So this is not the first time. But the conservation land has not been put in this position before. The conservation land was created in the 1980s, but even before that, the Coromandel was made a forest park in the 1970s. So there's a lot of issues about this land being up for sale, and the process they're suggesting is very minimal. There's no public involvement in it, but there is the involvement of iwi up to a very small degree, and only if there's a possibility of treaty settlements, which is really very much limiting the discussion, because a lot of the land is not open to treaty settlements, because a lot of the Crown land is basically being set aside for dock. So it's like after the Fast Track bill, we're now being hit in the face with something even more undermining of our beautiful areas. One thing they do say is that if the area is the best example of a endangered species area or endangered ecosystem, it can be protected. But, you know, that would be about less than 60% of the land probably is not going to be called the best. So they're focusing on the idea that you choose an example of something that's really good and then everything else can be sold off. And this isn't conservation, and it certainly isn't the will of the people around here. You know, we had a market stall to inform our locals about this on the weekend. People just absolutely furious because this area, both in terms of culture and in terms of treaty and in terms of local economy, you know, this land is really important, and it's really important to the reason why many people from Auckland come here. So, you know, we are expecting that Aucklanders, once they know about it, will be pretty angry too.
And conservation land is a pretty unclear term. What makes a thing, I guess, conservation land? What makes an area of land conservation land? And if it is sold, will it see some of the same protections, some of the same policies surrounding it, or will it just be basically up for anyone to do whatever they want with?
Under this government, it's a free-for-all, so there are no proposed protections for or caveats like conservation caveats on it. But your question about what makes land conservation is that if you look at an area like where I live, the ranges provide us with fresh water, and the forests, which were once devastated by mining and all kinds of other activities that weren't appropriate on these mountains, are recovering. And those recovering lands include rare species like the 200-million-year-old Archie frog species and others, but they're also buffer zones for those creatures to recover. So you need land around the most protected species so that they've got somewhere where they're not going to be impacted by development. But not only does this bill suggest sale, it also says that it introduces a new economic clause in the purpose of the bill, which says that conservation, looking after the natural resources, is one goal, but the other goal is maximising development to the greatest extent possible under law. And, you know, they're talking about amenities like shopping and restaurants and things being possible within the dock estate. They're talking about commercialisation, privatisation and sale all in one breath. So it's a really, really sneaky and incredibly serious attack on what I think many people hold dear, which is the idea that the land itself has a function in enhancing the quality of not only just the different species that live there, and not only just human beings, but for its own sake. And in terms of Te Tiriti or Waitangi, like once this land's sold, those guys will never have a chance to actually apply for some of the most sacred places, which I know exist in this area, because it, once it's private, there is no way you can claim it.
And so now, you mentioned earlier the kind of legal precedent that's been in place in this region around protecting the land. What is that legal precedent, and how does this law undercut that?
Okay, so under the there's an act called the Crown Minerals Act, which deals with the minerals in this area nationally. And in the 1990s, we fought our guts out, and we managed to persuade government to create this thing called Schedule 4, which was areas where you could not mine, particularly open cast mining. And that, for our area, because we were the flagship of this, but for our area, that was all the conservation land plus the inner waters of the Hauraki Gulf, so that you could not mine that land north of this road called the Kōpu Hekawai, which is the big Thames highway that fell in the hole during the last cyclone, but has now been fixed. And so we wanted the whole of the Hauraki to be under that law, but we couldn't get it. We just got north of Thames, basically Thames North, and that still stands. Except that this law has been very carefully drafted to make sure that that land north of the Kōpu Hekawai is open for sale. So although theoretically they can't open cast mine north of Thames, if they can buy it, then that just undermines the whole project, and they will be able to underground mine, which is the big battle we have in the 2020s. The big battle is no longer open cast. It's the fact that mining companies can underground mine. And this means that all of this land is going to be, it doesn't really matter what Schedule 4 says if the land is no longer Schedule 4.
And I lastly wanted to ask, it's been a pretty tricky time under this government for people to be seeing all of these policies around, you know, the fast track bill, around lots of other stuff, the gender bill that's currently going through, and wondering what they can do about it. Is there something that people can go out and do about this policy right now?
Just watch this space, because there's going to be events in Auckland. The national environmental groups, as well as us locally, are very aware of this. So there will be opportunities for Aucklanders to participate in that. If you've got the energy, just go onto the government website, Parliament website, and make a 3-minute submission about why you oppose the bill. That is always useful, because normally, I think we're all punch drunk from doing this, but actually right before an election, they suddenly start getting interested in public opinion, governments. So now's a good time to have an opinion and to bother with that annoying process. It's very quick and easy to make a submission. But also just watch the space, because there will be action that you can, that you know, the people of your city can participate in. And I think it's really, really important that you do, because people need to get out of the city. I mean, it's cheap for younger people to be able to get here. We're only an hour and a half away. We have beautiful forests and amazing places to walk, to hang out, to be with your friends, and relatively cheap camping grounds. To actually enjoy being a human in the natural world is really important to our well-being. And we don't want that stuff to be sold off so that somebody else can mine it or make a profit out of it. This is the right of your generation to enjoy this stuff. So, yeah, we just need you to be aware of those opportunities. Just make a quick submission until that closes on July 2. The only good news, Casper, is that probably not be through the Select Committee till November, and we might have a new government. So the other thing younger people must do is please vote. Just vote so that we can vote these people out and stop attacking humans and stop attacking the land.
That was Chair of Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki, Catherine Delahunty, speaking to me about the new Conservation Amendment Bill and how it could affect local conservation efforts in the Coromandel Hauraki region.
That was The Green World.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Keep here.
That was I Am a Tree by Big Psy. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
The Trump administration and the United States President Donald Trump has announced a peace deal between the US and Iran, bringing over 100 days of conflict to a potential close. The deal focuses, however, on the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, begging a question of whether this peace comes as a strategic loss for the US. Additionally, the conflict has further eroded the standing of and trust in the United States globally, furthering their precarious position. I spoke with Associate Professor in Global Studies at the University of Auckland, Chris Ogden, about the peace deal and what might come next. This peace deal between US and Iran, what sort of framework for peace are we seeing here?
So we don't know all the details at the moment. It certainly seems to be covering many of the aspects that we've heard mentioned over the last few months, relating to who controls the Strait of Hormuz, nuclear controls for Iran, what happens to some frozen assets that the US holds, and also some consideration of Israel's actions towards Lebanon.
And so other than a potential end to this military conflict, what is this peace deal actually fixing?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. So realistically, it's always been unclear what the US has wanted to achieve from this conflict. And certainly the way that the peace deal looks is that they haven't achieved any of those things. And in many ways, they've probably actually made Iran's position stronger. So at times, the US president has talked about removing Iran's missile capability. That's not part of the peace deal. They've tried to have a more amenable leader in place. That's also not happened. They've also said that they would pull out Iran's nuclear enriched uranium. That also is yet to happen, but that might happen at a future stage. And certainly there hasn't been any movement in terms of disarming Hezbollah. So overall, it seems to be more of a strategic defeat for the US than anything else.
And looking at this particularly in the context of the Trump administration, what does the state of this peace deal as maybe a strategic defeat say about the Trump administration's approach to global politics, to the way that they engage with the rest of the world?
So I think what the conflict has shown overall is, first of all, that the US under Trump has a disregard for its allies. So we shouldn't forget that allies in the region and more broadly, first of all, weren't warned about the conflict. Then they were castigated and attacked for not joining the conflict. And it's also shown, particularly for allies in the Middle East, that they can't be fully and adequately protected by the US. So we can think about all the countries that have been attacked by Iran, for example. But even more broadly, that the US militarily maybe isn't the modern fighting force that it ought to be. So we can think about it's got all these aircraft carriers, but it couldn't put them too close to Iran for fear of being attacked. It's depleted half of its own missile resources from across the world, including pulling them out of other regions, and still they haven't been able to win. So I think psychologically for the US, in terms of building distrust of its allies, again, certainly not a victory.
When we look at kind of the way that the rest of the world is going to react to this peace deal, when we look at especially on the pressure with the Strait of Hormuz on oil prices globally, can we expect kind of the rest of the world to get some benefit from this peace deal?
So this is the big question. I mean, first of all, if there is a peace deal, it's not going to solve the impending economic crisis which is coming, in that the vast majority of countries in the world are running out of oil and gas. And that won't be made better for at least 3 to 4 months. And certainly in terms of oil production and the damage that's been done to Iran's production, maybe not for a year or more. So there are direct consequences in that regard. Certainly most countries will welcome greater stability. One thing we haven't discussed is it seems from differing reports that Iran will be able to charge transit fees. And if that is the case, then that means that all fuel coming out of the Middle East will be more expensive. So that will have long-term consequences.
When we look at the relationships between the United States of America and some of its allies, like Trump has made an announcement about the peace deal today in France. When we look at big countries like in the European Union, where there's this, the trust of the US has sort of eroded, how do you expect this particular conflict and other engagements of the Trump administration, how do you expect this to kind of have ramifications for the state of the world when we look at the influence of blocs such as the European Union or those that would traditionally be American allies?
So I think the deep realization from all countries is that the US cannot be relied upon. It is fermenting chaos in many ways, fermenting instability. This conflict was initiated by the US and then they've lost that conflict. And in particular, in the European context, European leaders have certainly not liked being attacked by Trump, being manipulated by Trump. So I think their focus will be upon a slow decoupling from the US where possible. But in the current context, this is quite difficult for them. So the US has been selling lots of oil and gas to Europe, for example, and there's still the ongoing specter of tariffs. But in general, Trump can't be relied upon. European and other leaders know that, and they'll be working in any way which they can to make sure that they're not beholden to the whims of the US president.
And kind of on the flip side, when we look at Iran, like you said, Iran's position maybe gets a little bit stronger coming out of this conflict. When we look at particularly the inclusion of maybe sanction relief in a peace deal, how do you expect Iran's diplomacy to kind of evolve out of this conflict? Does it seem like it might be a more open field for Iran to exercise diplomacy with other nations?
So I think this is the big unknown. Certainly, you could say that Iran's position in the region has been damaged diplomatically in terms of, say, relations with the Gulf states. But also they will be able to frame that in terms of these are the actions of the US and kind of look what happens if you're very close to the US. At the same time, though, they have been able to assert themselves against the US and assert themselves against Israel and potentially involving protecting Lebanon and, to a degree, Palestine. So in that way, I think kind of a balanced outcome. More broadly, their assertion that they've been able to stand up to American pressure, control the states, the straits rather than control the oil coming out of it, maybe probably puts them in a stronger position with other countries, particularly across Asia. So all the ones who really need that oil and gas will now need to have much closer relations with Tehran.
My final question here, and maybe most importantly, can we expect this peace deal to hold?
I think it's really unlikely, in my opinion. So we should think about there have been previous stages in this conflict where the US president has said that there'll be a ceasefire between themselves and Iran. That hasn't really held. The biggest factor here is that Israel has broken that ceasefire repeatedly, particularly towards Lebanon, and now controls maybe a fifth of Lebanese territory. I think there's a huge degree of mistrust between both sides. And we shouldn't also forget two other factors. One is, Trump has said it on at least 40 occasions that they're very close to a peace deal and it hasn't emerged. And then the other side of this is often the timing of these announcements. So they often happen on a Friday and then often don't materialize by the Monday. And there is some speculation that this is to do with stock market manipulation. So this is a way of kind of boosting the oil price, dropping the oil price in different ways. And certainly that seems to have been a factor within these dynamics. So overall, as much as it's very pessimistic, I feel it's unlikely that it will hold or that it will even be signed. You know, I think there are two realities here. There's the Trump reality. It's all sorted. It's all finished. I want it to go away. And there's the other perspective, the Iranian perspective, which is we're going to get what we want. We're going to get more. We're the ones who are winning. And I think that's what we're going to see in the coming days. If there really is a peace deal, about who's won, who hasn't won, and it'll be a contest of narratives.
That was Associate Professor in Global Studies at the University of Auckland, Chris Ogden, on potential peace between the US and Iran.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Last week, the Labour Party announced a policy, if they win the election, that would cap public transport fees at $20 a week. This has been touted as a real cost of living boost. However, while the savings for a user of public transport are significant, questions remain about the details of these changes, how the cap will be implemented, and what else is needed to really provide assistance to those relying on public transport. I spoke with Senior Lecturer in Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Timothy Welch, about the policy and these questions. Last week, Labour announced a major policy to cap public transport fees at $20 a week. When we look at this at a cost of living measure, what are we currently seeing with the price of public transport in Aotearoa at the moment and how that affects New Zealanders?
Well, we know that there are people that are impacted by just the cost of living, but the cost of transportation, especially when we look at the cost of rising fuel and the cost of owning a vehicle and the rising cost of fares for public transportation. It's all going up. So this addresses, in a way, the cost of getting to work and getting to school and getting to the grocery store for a good number of people across New Zealand.
And looking at this policy on the face of it, how can we kind of expect this to be implemented if it comes to pass?
Well, we're kind of short on details exactly how this will work. And there are some big question marks because Auckland and Christchurch both already have fare caps in place. In the case of Auckland, it's $50 a week and Christchurch is $30. So the question kind of becomes, how does this policy work with those caps in place already? Who foots the bill? Do they get reimbursed? And then for those regions and transport systems that don't have a cap, who's paying the bill first and then how does it get paid back? But the idea is generally, I think, anything that exceeds that $20 cap, the central government will pay the bill for.
And you touched on it there with the kind of overlap between some other plans. But when we look at this announcement, what is left unaddressed with the way that both the public transport system currently operates, but also maybe if the government truly wants to make this, you know, an effective cost of living measure, what's left out here? What it's missing?
So there are some question marks again around the cap. What happens if Auckland decides they don't want that $50 cap in place anymore, Christchurch the $30 cap? What does that really do to the total cost of the program? Does the central government still pay for that difference in fare, where they are fairly expensive in Auckland and can be in Christchurch as well? So those are big question marks. The other issue is kind of who's targeted here. What's really the relief being offered? So we know that the people that rely on public transport the most, and it kind of costs them the most as well, are those that are, let's say, on the Community Connect card, or those that are under 25 and they struggle to make to pay for those fares. This isn't really targeted directly at those groups. So, you know, ideally we'd see something that focused initially on those groups that are already paying a larger portion of their income towards fares. That would be a really good way to kind of start to address cost of living for those that are struggling the most, and then open it up for others that use public transport. And then the other question comes in, what happens on the busiest bus and rail lines for Auckland? That's kind of the busways that go into the city from the North Shore or from the west side of Auckland. Those can be very congested at peak hours. So if we're not providing more service there, then are we just making people wait for the bus a little bit longer for the next one, which isn't necessarily a terrible thing, but it can be difficult to plan around.
And so, yeah, you've touched on it there towards the end, but when we look at how, you know, we have this cost reduction measure for the
user of public transport. But when we look at the system as a whole, especially in a city like Auckland, what actually still needs to change with the way that we approach public transport to make this a cost-effective and all-around effective method of transport for Aucklanders?
You know, for Auckland, it's always a question of, does the bus, does the train, does the ferry get me where I need to go? And does it get me there in a way that I can kind of plan my schedule reasonably around? I think the first part is true for many people. We do have a very comprehensive public transport system. Our trains are fairly limited, but our bus network is, to use a cliche, is world class. It's pretty good. There are cases where we could have more services and fewer people waiting for the next bus, or, you know, ideally you'd just go outside and you'd go to the bus stop and the bus would be there in 5-10 minutes. You wouldn't have to plan your day around that bus coming. So those are major issues where we kind of want service to be a lot better. But, you know, whenever we reduce the price of public transport, we expect more people to use it. And some of those people will come from cars, and naturally that means there'll be less traffic on the road. And so there'll be kind of this benefit. Labor Party is saying maybe 6% increase in public transport ridership, and a smaller portion of that will come from cars. But we'd also like to see things like better bus lanes that are more connected throughout the city and operating for longer periods of time throughout the day, so that those buses can actually compete with the time a car takes to drive from point A to point B.
And kind of just to look at all of this, when it comes to a support policy for public transport users like the one from Labor, going forward with this policy, and for any party that wants to, you know, bring their own policy, what do you sort of want to see alongside these fare caps in terms of like information or the way that it works? What do you want to see from these parties in their policy to make sure that we get that meaningful support?
What we really need is less single ideas on how to address cost of living or just public transport in general, and a comprehensive transport plan that's long-term and takes these things outside of the political cycle. We cannot really plan for public transport on a 3-year political cycle. This needs to be a years-long process to improve public transport. So ideally, we'd have either party providing ideas that are, you know, encapsulating this long-term thinking across cost and reliability and multiple modes for years to come, and not just a single policy to address a pinch point at the current moment.
That was Senior Lecturer in Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Timothy Welch, on the Labour Party's proposed cap on public transport fares.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Workers' First Union has recently released a report covering Aotearoa's ambulance system, calling for urgent reform and public funding from the government. Various issues are outlined in the report, including New Zealand's ageing population, a growing trans-Tasman wage gap bleeding the workforce, the collapse of charitable giving, and a fuel crisis. First Union says if these problems are not addressed, they risk getting significantly worse in years to come. The report suggests catching the ambulance up with the rest of New Zealand's health service and making it fully publicly funded for the betterment of those who rely on emergency health response and its workers. To talk about the failing Aotearoa ambulance system and how it can be fixed, Monday Wire producer Thomas talks to Deputy Secretary for Workers First Union, Anita Rosentreter.
Starting off, can you explain some of the problems with our current ambulance system that this report highlights?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the core problems is that our ambulance services are effectively contracted out to charities, St John being the major one. And so the vast majority of our health system is a public system. And then we have this one sort of segment of the system, which is ambulance services, that's sort of carved off to the side and is instead delivered by these charities. And So there's all sorts of issues in terms of coordination between them, inefficiencies in the system, and then there's the matter of, well, they're not being funded enough as well, so they can't really carry out the services to the degree that, you know, you'd like to see with the funding that they're being given. They're put in a position where they have to fundraise to complement what the government gives them. So that's why you see people around on the street with St. John buckets collecting coins to try and make up the difference. And it's also the reason that if someone calls an ambulance, they end up with a bill, because they complement their funding with what they call patient co-payments. And so the other issue, big issue, I guess, is that this system was kind of put in place a long, long time ago when we were looking at a very different scale of ambulance services, and now we have a lot more demand on our ambulance services, and we're looking at a drastically increasing ageing population. And so as anyone can probably guess, more, if we have more people who are in that sort of 65 plus age group, we're going to have more ambulance call outs, and they're actually going to be more complex as well. So there's going to be more demand on our ambulance services, and government funding is just not keeping up with the pace of that. So what we want to see is the union for ambulance officers, and so this comes directly from the workers themselves, is 100% funding of ambulance services in New Zealand. There should be no question about that. Should be publicly funded, and then in the longer term, it should be brought back into public hands as well, and that will deliver the best outcomes for patients.
Is there any particular reason why the ambulance system hasn't caught up with the rest of the health system in Aotearoa, and in particular still relies on charity funding?
Sort of a hangover from the way that it was originally established. So we just didn't have, you know, we're talking about the late 1800s, we didn't have an ambulance service. There was a need there, so the St. John charity stepped in at the time. In Wellington, there's this, the story goes that the mayor was walking down Lambton Quay, came across a man who was in distress and needed an ambulance, and there wasn't one available, and that's how Wellington Free Ambulance was established. And basically they've just existed ever since, and they've been kind of incorporated into the wider system and formalised, and it's just kind of continued. So they're a relic of the past, and they're definitely not suited to the current modern New Zealand environment.
A lot of the issues you mentioned and that are in the report, you know, an ageing population, fuel crisis, Trans-Tasman wage gap, feel like we're kind of only at the beginning of their potential impact. If this report isn't taken seriously and listened to, how bad off could the system get in, let's say, 10 years?
Yeah, it could absolutely get a lot worse. And I think we sort of can become a little bit complacent in New Zealand, because there's always a kind of an overseas example you can look to and say, oh, well, at least, you know, at least it's not the US, where we've got this fully privatised health system, and you just can't get healthcare if you don't have the money or insurance or whatever. But the thing is that we really don't want to end up there, do we? So we have to work really hard to ensure that there isn't the slipping that happens. And this is just one example of where the public health system doesn't cover this very, very crucial part of our health system. And essentially, there is a lack of transparency around it because of that. There's a lack of accountability around it because of that. That's the other important thing. People need to remember that if something's publicly funded, then there's a certain degree of accountability and transparency that comes along with that, and that's a good thing for us as taxpayers and as a society, being able to make sure that these services are being delivered well and that people are being looked after in the process.
And the government did announce a $35 million increase to funding in the recent budget. Is this enough to help the system, or is it still short of the mark?
Definitely still short. It's obviously good to see any increase in funding. That's fantastic. But what's clear is that most of that will be swallowed up pretty immediately by these hubs that they've green-lighted in Auckland. It's certainly not enough to meet the full costs of the ambulance service, even as they are, and then definitely not enough to meet the future costs, given these added pressures, like you said, the ageing population, the massive Trans-Tasman wage gap and so on.
That was Deputy Secretary for the Workers' First Union, Anita Rosentreter, talking to Monday Wire producer Thomas about Aotearoa's failing ambulance system and how it can be fixed.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki a māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, University of Auckland's Chris Ogden and Timothy Welch, Chair of Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki, Catherine Delahunty, and Deputy Secretary for the Workers' First Union, Anita Rosentreter. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Next up, you're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got The 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.